Welcome to another in the teaching series of Dr. Ken Boa, President of Reflections Ministries and Trinity House Publishers. His talk today is part 9 of A Biblical View of Work. Here to begin his study is our teacher, Dr. Ken Boa.
We are going to continue our journey into the realm of work as we reflect on how we think. And that's an issue that we all struggle with on a day-by-day basis. There's so much uncertainty in life, so much turbulence and unexpected twists and turns in the journey of life that we wonder what all this is about. We think we're doing well, and all of a sudden, all the things we were working on seem to fall apart. There are just kinds of times when we are happen to be at the right place and at the right time, and they work. And other times, you work hard, and nothing happens. And this is a process we have all experienced. So the biblical perspective on life and work is, I think, very, very rich and redemptive, because it gives us an orientation, I think a stable way of looking at the uncertainties of life. And that's what we need as men, is we need a measure of stability in a turbulent environment. We're talking about the themes of working hard but not overworking, and the sluggard. The idea of the tragic comic character of the sluggard, remember, in our last time together. Little sleep, little slumber, a little folding of the hands to rest. He deceives himself by the smallness of his surrenders and compromises his integrity. And what I want us to explore as we think now is this whole idea of where does our ability come from? And because it's one thing for us to work hard, we don't want to overwork. At the same time, the scriptures tell us and affirm that work has genuine value and it can be done for his glory and honor. But part of how we think is to the realization that all that we are and all that we have is derivative. It's an easy thing for a man to make himself, especially if he enjoys a measure of this world's success, a person who supposes that he earned all this. And there's this powerful temptation for us to consider what we suppose we've earned when it was God who gave us, for example, our very ability. Romans 12:6 tells us about this concept of our ability. Let me just read that for you here so we get an idea. In Romans 12:6, he makes it very clear that everything is derivative. Since we have gifts that differ according to the grace given to us, each of us is to exercise them accordingly. God has given you certain abilities, certain gifts, certain aptitudes. And he is the one then who actually tells us that these are things that are given to you for a purpose. In fact, if you go back a little bit earlier, he says through verse 3, through the grace given to me, I say to everyone among you not to think more highly of himself than he ought to think, but so as to have sound judgment, as God has allotted to each a measure of faith. So don't take yourself too seriously. Recognize that all of life is gift and grace, and all comes from him. It's all derived from him. I think it's a very important perspective, because otherwise we will suppose that it was our own independent capacity that led us to the acquisition of what we now have. Furthermore, it's not only he who gives us our ability, he gives us our intelligence as well. He gives us our mental acumen. And it is God who really illuminates the minds. And in Daniel chapter 2, and verse 21, as he was reflecting upon the revelation that God had given to him, and he said the mystery was revealed to Daniel in the night vision, and the mystery of the king's dream. And then Daniel's response in part in chapter 2, verse 20 and 21, let the name of God be blessed forever and ever, for wisdom and power belong to him. These are his. All wisdom, all power, really, are derivative. It is he who changes the times and the epochs. He removes kings, and he establishes kings. He gives wisdom to wise men, and knowledge to men of understanding, so that any wisdom that we have is ultimately derivative from the mind of God himself. This verse also teaches a basic theme of the book of Daniel, that God's the one who raises up kings and deposes them. He's not looking at world history, wringing his hands and worrying what's going to happen next. The fact is, he's in control, though we might sometimes wonder what on earth is going on, why he's allowing this to happen. We look back over the history and we begin to realize there is indeed a pattern and that God is accomplishing a purpose. And Daniel makes it very clear, speaking to the Jewish people, that though they are now in captivity and in exile, nevertheless, God will in fact deliver them, and there is an ultimate future for them. And that the things that we have seen through history have been signs of God's great acts of deliverance. And we know that the scriptures predicted as well that they would be scattered throughout the four corners of the earth and then be regathered. And ultimately, the promises that were made in the major and minor prophets will be fulfilled. And the Messiah will come. He will rule and reign on the throne of David forever and ever. So it's a glorious picture that we have. I'm reminded when I think about God kind of delivering them of three major festivals that they celebrate. Passover is one, and then a second one is Purim, and the third one is Hanukkah. Now, two of those are not actually formally instituted in the Hebrew Bible, although Purim is described and mentioned. But it's an interesting thing that with Passover, it celebrated what? It celebrated the victory of God over the oppression of the Egyptians. And you recall they were, the horse and the rider were into the sea, and that he delivered them with outstretched arms, with signs and wonders, and brought them out in the Exodus. This is a celebration of the Exodus deliverance. And they were really people who were going to be killed, and there was a systematic plan to eliminate the Jews effectively, and then God delivered them, did he not? And then they celebrated this event as the Passover, and it's an annual reminder of God's great work. In the book of Esther, if you've read it, I don't know if it's an interesting thing. I bet not all of you have read the whole Old Testament. Am I right in my assumption? I'm probably right. This is your assignment. You need to work your way through that. It's part of the Bible. You ought to read it. I mean, that's why it's a fascinating thing. I do tell people this. This is parenthetical. That people ought to, if you're a new believer, you need to read the New Testament three times before you read the Old. You really do. Because the worst thing you can do if you're a brand new believer or if you're a seeker is to start with Genesis. It'll kill you. Because by the time you get to Leviticus, you wonder where things are going there. It goes crazy. And then if you make it through there and get to Deuteronomy, you think you've seen that before because you have more laws and so forth. And then you lose your storyline when you get to the Psalms. So what happened to the story and so forth? It's really confusing. So I tell people, make sure that you read the New Testament three times. Then you're ready to do that. And even then, it's good to have a balanced diet reading the Old and the New. And that's why, by the way, it's fun to watch people if they have gilt-edged Bibles to see where the gold is still bright and shiny. You see? And it'll always be in the minor prophets, I promise you that. They haven't been reading Nahum and Habakkuk of late. Am I right? But Esther is a great book, actually, and it's an extraordinary portrait of God's deliverance. And this Haman wanted to actually have another plan to exterminate the Jews, just like the Egyptians wanted to systematically eliminate them from the face of the earth. So Haman had a plot, and it was going to be looked like it was going to be successful. And the story is that Haman, ironically, was the one who was hung and destroyed, and his family, and not the Jews. And they were delivered, and they celebrated. And it's called the Feast of Purim. The third feast is when they were delivered from the Maccabeans delivered them from Antiochus and from the Seleucids, and because their temple had been desecrated, and it was a horrible experience. And God raised up the Maccabeans, Judas Maccabee and John Hyrcanus and others, and they celebrated this extraordinary event that where the light appeared to continue, the oil for the lamp continued and did not run out. So they were delivered also from an attempt to destroy them and wipe them off the planet. And then what did they do? They celebrated with a feast, Hanukkah. So it's been said that the Jews have this pattern here where they basically say, they tried to kill us, God deliver us, let's eat. All three of those are just that. God delivered us, they didn't kill us, we're alive, let's eat. That's basically what it comes down to. But what I love about that is it is a picture, isn't it, of God's sovereign hand. And what part of that picture tells us is that not only God's ruling over circumstances and that he's in control and he's not wondering what's going to happen next. And though we cannot see this side of eternity what's happening, he does. He sees on the other side and knows where things are heading. And furthermore, he raises up people for his purposes, and he gives wise wisdom to people, and he gives intelligence, and he gives knowledge to men of understanding. It is all derivative from the mind of God. This is very important for us to grasp. A third thing that God grants to us is our wealth. Now, this is one that sometimes is harder for people to buy into. And I want you to look at Deuteronomy chapter 8 here. And again, I'm not going to go into any detail here, but this is the account as the people are being prepared for their conquest of the land. This is the Upper Desert Discourse, you might call it. This is basically a kind of retelling of the law. And here Moses is reviewing God's works in their lives. And in doing so, he reminds them that the fact is that you were brought out by me, by the living God, and that we actually saw his hand in our midst. And that he says, don't forget the Lord your God, that he actually brought you into this land of abundance. And he says that when you entered into this land, it's bringing you to a place of brooks of water, of fountains and springs flowing forth in valleys and hills, verse 7, a land of wheat and barley, of vines and fig trees and pomegranates, a land of olive oil and honey, a land where you will eat food without scarcity and so forth. It says, when you have eaten and are satisfied, verse 10, you shall bless the Lord your God for the good land which he has given to you. And then he says, beware that you don't forget the Lord your God by not keeping his commandments and so forth. Otherwise, when you've eaten and are satisfied, and you've built good houses and lived in them, when your herds and your flocks multiply, your silver and gold multiply, and all that you have multiplies, what'll happen? If things go too well, if everything falls into your hand, what'll happen? Typical process. Then your heart, what's that?
I was just going to say,
take the credit for it. Your heart becomes proud. You think you did it. And you forget the Lord your God who brought you from the hand of Egypt out of the house of slavery. I think that's a very significant word. It says he led you through the great and terrible wilderness with its fiery serpents and scorpions and thirsty ground where there was no water. He brought water for you out of the rock of flint. You know, he's reminding you, remember where you really came from. You were a rabble of slaves here who have now been brought safely through these treacherous places. In the wilderness, he fed you manna, which your fathers did not know, that he might humble you and that he might test you and do good for you in the end. And here's the thing. Otherwise, you may say in your heart, verse 17, my power and the strength of my hand brought me this wealth. You see, when you forget God, you will then, when things go well, attribute it to your own efforts. And then he says, but you shall remember the Lord your God, for it is he who gives you the power to make wealth. That's a little verse that's often overlooked. He gives you the very power, verse 18, to make wealth. that he may confirm his covenant, which he swore to your fathers, as it is to this day. I think it is easy for a man to forget this, and that this can easily occur where we suppose that we are in control of these things, and that we really have the power that we need. There's another verse I want to add to this verse. It's found in Hosea chapter 13. I promise you, you haven't been reading in Hosea. Am I right about that? I'm probably right. In Hosea chapter 13, I'll let you, little puffs of dust will pop up all over as you're looking for Hosea. Let me just read you this little verse here. When God says, I have been the Lord your God since the land of Egypt. He keeps referring to this motif of the Exodus because it's a reminder motif. Don't forget who you are, where you came from, what you would be apart from me. This is a metaphor for our lives as well. Do never forget what you would be apart from him. He says, I've been the Lord your God since the land of Egypt, and you were not to know any God except me. There is no Savior besides me. I cared for you in the wilderness, in the land of drought. As then it says, and here's the chilling verse, in verse 13, verse 6, as they had their pasture, they became satisfied, and being satisfied, their heart became proud, therefore they forgot me. Did you hear that process? See, a man is more likely, and Gary's point about the prayers being more fervent during times of adversity. They are. Suddenly you become a real man of God, don't you? A real prayer warrior when things really fall upon you and everything falls apart. Suddenly you realize you never were in control, and you cry out to the Lord your God for deliverance, and you pray fervently like you haven't normally been praying. Here's what he's saying. What happens, though, when God answers your prayer? What happens when he delivers you? Then what? If you're not careful, we will fall into this trap that so many have fallen in before. You have your pasture, you become satisfied. And then once you're satisfied, you become proud and you forget God. It's exactly what we heard in Deuteronomy. Do not forget the Lord your God. Because when you forget him, you suppose the might of your strength brought you this wealth, and you become arrogant and foolish. And then, because the human heart is bent toward autonomy, independence, and arrogance. The fear of God is radical dependence upon the Lord our God. Yes, David.
How long after the Exodus was that written?
After the Deuteronomy text?
The
run in Hosea was actually written during the northern captivity of Israel. So that would be much later in the 8th century B.C. So this was considerably later. But the Exodus motif was constantly being referred to throughout the Hebrew Bible, all the way through. So that's because that becomes a motif for remembrance. And I think that's not a bad thing for you and I to do, is to consider our Exodus. Have you ever thought of it that way? That God has delivered you from oppression and tyranny, from the taskmaster of sin and death and the law. And he has set you free and put you on a high place. You were formerly aliens and strangers. Now you become children of the beloved children of the living God. Do not forget that deliverance. Otherwise, you'll take that grace for granted, and after a while, when things go your way, will begin to be tempted to forget God and think it was your strength and your might that brought you this wealth or this ability or this sort of a thing. It is human nature, and human nature has not changed these thousands of years. That's why the scriptures are perpetually relevant, because they speak to the condition of man, because God knows the heart through and through, and he understands what we are like. And although our circumstances and culture changes, the human heart does not. Thus, these words of authority and these words of exhortation, encouragement, and warning are apropos for us as much today as they were for the people who first read them. This is a very, very important instruction. Do not forget that. Otherwise, you'll be like Bart Simpson when he was asked to offer the prayer, say grace at a meal. And he says, God, we paid for all this stuff ourselves, so thanks for nothing. Well, that's not a really good prayer. You gotta kind of watch that. You know, we did this ourselves, and Bart's forgetting something. Where did that come from? You see, where did it all come from? So, but, you know, though that's a funny kind of an image, yet it's not too far from a way people often approach it. This is why it's fascinating, in fact, thinking about grace at meals, how perfunctory that can be as well. You ever thought of it this way? It's always fascinating, too, when you have your relatives and you're together with your relatives on Thanksgiving, and then somebody's looking around for who's going to pray. You know, it's always interesting. All of a sudden, they feel that they have this obligation they haven't been doing the rest of the year. You know, this is like the Holly and Lily Christians, the ones who go at Christmas and Easter. Now, that's pretty much it. The only time they'll darken the doors of a church is Christmas and Easter. So I call them the Holly and Lily crowd. But basically, the Thanksgiving deal is the same deal. All of a sudden now, well, we have this tradition that we pray, and they're hoping that they have a professional in their midst. So I'm usually consigned to be the professional in my family, which amuses me immensely. All of a sudden, you know, they get real spiritual. You ever have this kind of happen? And there's this bizarre moment of embarrassment when they really don't know what they're doing or how to do it. You see, they're not accustomed to thanking God. This is actually quite typical. When's the last time we thank God, you might want to ask, and those kinds of things. That's why I like what G.K. Chesterton said. He says, you thank God for, you say grace at meals, very good. But I say grace before I go to the play, before I engage in sports, before I read a book. And he goes on through these things. What does he mean by that? I say grace before I go to the theater or any of these things. What he's saying is, I want to have the mindset of gratitude for all the good things and graces I've been given, not just the food. But everything. See, that's a pretty smart thing. To be thankful for all things is a beautiful thing, because it is the imagery here that God is well pleased with the fruit of lips that give thanks to his name. In Hebrews 13, it describes that. So giving thanks to God for our ability, giving thanks to him for any mental acumen we've been given, any understanding of this world, giving thanks to him that he is the one who actually gives us the power to make wealth. Your very lifeblood, your very breath is given to you. Don't suppose that you earn this apart from God, as so many do. And it's furthermore God who gives you even your promotions. He can elevate you, he can take you down. Look at Psalm 75, verses 6 to 7. And it's an interesting idea here. God's more involved than we might perhaps want to admit in these kinds of things. But in Psalm 75, verses 6 to 7, not from the east nor from the west nor from the desert comes exaltation, but God is the judge. He puts down one and exalts another, and I think you can apply that to any context of life. He can raise you up, and he can bring you down. And it's that quick and that simple. And so we recognize, if that's true, that if we truly buy this, my thinking then should be one not of autonomy, but of radical dependence upon him, that he has gifted me with these circumstances and abilities. He has given me a sphere of influence, and all things come from him, through him, and to him. And therefore, I will have a radical dependence upon him, not take him for granted, but welcome him into the day-by-day decision-making process, and not have the autonomous attitude that I'll only come to him when I think I need him. That's the danger. We'll typically only go to him when we perceive our need. And the scriptures invite us to see you always are in need. You just don't perceive it. We're always desperate men. We just don't usually see it, because we build up this kind of shell, this illusory world of apparent control that we build around ourselves, that to buffer ourselves from the hard winds of anxiety. And normally they work, and you believe that that little shell that you've created is something that gives you a measure of autonomy and control. And then when the winds come harder, the hurricanes of life come and break through that, suddenly you get a hard dose of reality that you never were in control. Any thoughts on that? This is a very important set of principles that I think you've got to bring with you to work. Yes.
What I'm trying to reconcile is, God's involved in our lives, He cares about us, but the rain falls on the crops of the wicked as well as the righteous. There's sort of a indifference as to our position or our circumstance in this world anyway.
Yeah, he's talking about the rain falls on both the wicked and the righteous. That's common grace. That God gives us, He gives us grace for all. But I'm specifically thinking here in terms of the details of our lives as followers of Jesus, that in those cases, the common grace will normally not be acknowledged. And I think it is the wise person who acknowledges that. Otherwise, they will they'll take the good things as if they earned them, and the bad things, they'll raise the fist against God. That'll be the typical thing. But I think that's a perspective. Yeah, there is common grace means that God has showered this upon the righteous and the unrighteous. And that is why in this world, perhaps you've noticed this of late, that in the New Covenant, that there is no direct correlation between righteousness and how well off we are in terms of the material goods of this life, or physical goods, or those kinds of things. Nor is there a direct correlation between unrighteousness and the same. This means, therefore, that it can well be that the righteous may suffer and the unrighteous may flourish. Maybe we've noticed that. And the idea that we often have, this naive view that, oh, the problem is just education and the problem is just the wealth. If you give people money and education, they'll be better people. If I read the scriptures aright, that's an illusion. In fact, last time I checked, some of the best educated and wealthy people I knew were some of the most unrighteous. It can work both ways. The Old Covenant, yes, tells us that there was the fruit of the vine. The Old Covenant related physical and material blessings and prosperity to obedience to Yahweh, because they were a covenant nation, a theocratic covenant community. But in the New Covenant, that is not the case. But the blessings now are the fruit of the Spirit, not the fruit of the vine. Now, so God may well then bless you in certain ways, but do not put your hope in something He did not promise in the New Covenant context. Under the New Covenant, then, you see many of the greatest saints suffering a great deal. Paul is only one example. The other disciples and the apostles and the followers of Jesus really did not flourish in according to this world's economy. That's why I really loathe the whole concept of the prosperity gospel, because it's inviting people to actually put their hope and trust in something God never promised. And there's a hope, they put their hope in those things. It's a dangerous thing. Yes?
Why would God gift us with certain talents, certain abilities, and then basically hide us under the bushel and not let those be used in certain situations?
Again, it goes back to that poem by John Milton. He says, "They also serve who only stand and wait." Talks about thousands at his bidding speed. He's talking about all these people who really do his service, and they post about land and ocean without rest. And so he speaks about people who are serving him in active ways. But then he pauses and says at the end, "They also serve, though, who only stand and wait." Why would that be? Why is it that some people do post over land and oceans and follow his bidding and accomplish great things, it would appear, and where others are called to stand and wait? Why would that be? God alone knows. But Milton, in that beautiful sonnet, reflects on the reality that before half his days were gone, he lost his eyesight, and it appeared that he lost his real abilities, and this great talent, which is death to hide, lodged with him useless. Well, how could that be? And Milton, though, significantly overcame that loss and did something very significant, that in spite of the fact that he would be blind for the last portion of his life, he would then have a secretary and he would dictate, and this is what's more incredible. The concept of dictating Paradise Lost is inconceivable to me. I got to be honest with you. Just an inconceivable achievement. The concept of Beethoven becoming totally deaf, what an irony, and yet composing his greatest symphony in total deafness. He could hear it in his mind's eye, but he would compose it, and he would not hear the thunderous applause when he was directing the orchestra. You see, he had to be turned around to see them applauding. It's a poignant moment, isn't it? That God sometimes gives us certain abilities that seem so out of proportion to our opportunity. Maybe you've all noticed this. Have you perhaps noticed that you have greater capacity than you can ever make in terms of contribution? Have you ever noticed that your abilities exceed your achievements? All of us, this is true for all of us, our abilities that God gives us will always outstrip our achievements. Your capacities will always go beyond whatever you can contribute. That, I think, is part of an intimation of the fact that we're not home yet. Why it is that God would choose to take this chosen vessel and not make it flourish or multiply when all that potential was there, and another seems to be used more fully, is a mystery only known to the hand and mind of God. But God gives us purposes. But I want to tell you, there's an analogy here. Although it seems that there's this tragic waste where some people have so much ability and don't have the opportunity to express it, I think that's actually true for all of us, just in different degrees. I believe the vast bulk of our capacity will not be realized in this life, but will be released in the next. And that all this frustration that we experience is a hint that you're not home yet. That we do not have time to do all that we know that the capacities of our nature tell us we're capable of doing. And in my view, that is a hint of the reality that you're not home. Time's taken your life away, and you know you're not going to be able to accomplish so much that you thought you could. Peter.
If we have this ability, don't we also have an obligation to find a way to better use the ability we can give?
I couldn't agree more. So Peter is rightly saying if we have this ability, we should look for opportunities to release that and to find ways of using it. And that's, I believe we need to do that. So that's our responsibility. But the outcome I cannot control. So at the end of the day, suppose I do engage in those things, but it seems to go nowhere. That's not my business. My business is to be faithful to the opportunities and the abilities he has given me, to be grateful for them, and then to let loose of the outcome. Only God can control that. So it's not to be passive, and that's why I'm glad, Peter, that you brought that up, because we're not talking about passivity here. We're talking about active engagement, but we're also saying that I can't control the outcome. None of us can. That's a very healthy thing for us to review, yes.
I recently talked to a friend that just came back from a mission trip to Haiti, and he made an interesting observation. He said that the things that we count as blessings, our car, our house, our 401k, our job, whatever, he said, those are actually a hindrance because we almost feel like we've earned those. And when you see these people with hate and need that have nothing, and yet they're dependent on God and their relationship closer because they don't have these.
Yes. Very often in those kinds of countries, in third world countries, there's a greater level of happiness or satisfaction, ironically, with it when they have less goods. It seems bizarre, but it seems that the more we have, the less content we are. It seems that there is this thing that inflates like addiction, that you have to have more and more to get less and less. So that that their realization of radical dependence, and they don't have all these toys and so forth, at least gives them a greater connection with reality. So they realize that. So that there can be a greater sense of happiness in that context. It's a very strange thing. Whereas we're in our culture, we suppose that the more of this world's goods we have, the happier we will be. And last time I checked, that just wasn't the case. Yes.
In Sunday school this past Sunday, I was astonished to hear that the problem with Christianity is that we believe that God is all powerful and all knowing, and it just kind of floored me
But it just seems like it's the antithesis of what I believe.
Yeah, he was talking about the fact that many times people use, even in Christian churches, the idea of pain, the problem of pain, to be a proof of some sort that God's not all-powerful. Well, you know, if you really analyze that line of argument, and this has been refuted so many times, it's phenomenal. It just keeps on popping up, though, like a bad penny. But the reality here is that the supposition, yeah, if God's all-powerful, then he would be able to defeat evil. If God's all-loving, he would want to defeat evil. Evil exists, therefore an all-powerful and all-loving God doesn't exist. It's not that simple. Because, among many other reasons, that evil has not yet been defeated, but will be defeated one day. And the other implies, if we don't understand the reasons behind it, then it can't be good. You see, that's the arrogance. If I can't figure it out, it can't be good. This is what drives a lot of bad theology. If it doesn't make sense to me, it can't be true. That is the height of arrogance. The reality here is that the kind of God they're believing in is not the God of the Bible. In fact, he's more of a giant creature. I really wish I could help out, but I'm out of control here. You know, I got to hope for the best here. Well, if you've had an eternity to make things right and you can't get it right, what makes me think you'll do it in the next eternity? You see, so there's no hope. That's not a God I can trust at all. He's utterly beneath the vision of the greatness of the God of the Bible. Furthermore, there's this whole mindset more and more in our culture, and I just want to be parenthetical about this, that we are moving into a culture where people who are followers of Jesus are getting seduced into the apprehension that somehow only the good virtues of God should be celebrated, but not the tough ones. Maybe you've noticed this lately. And we have so eradicated the holiness and justice of God that we say love wins. Love triumphs over justice. Last time I checked, that's not the case. That justice and love can be actually met, where God can be just and the justifier of the one who has faith in Christ Jesus. At the moment you put the attributes of God at loggerheads and focus on the goodness and love and grace of God and ignore the holiness and wrath and fear of God, you're in trouble, because it's not the God of the Bible, and you're evaluating him according to your own understanding and your own emotional system. And then you'll use proof texts to try to support your position. But this is, I think, in part because our culture, there is no fear of God before our eyes. There is no awareness of the sinfulness of sin and the holiness of God, and therefore we figure that things aren't so bad, so let's let them all in. And this is a dangerous mindset that we're buying into here, where when I read the scriptures, I see a God whose wrath and goodness go together, whose holiness and compassion go together, whose justice and mercy go together. That those attributes of God that might seem hard to us are just as ultimate as the other. And when people fail to see the horror of sin for what it is, then we suppose that he'll just wince and look the other way. And so it's a perspective, I think, we need to embrace, where we get the full counsel of Scripture and not be theological innovators who just try to come up with an idea. If I don't understand it, I guess it ain't true. And so then we come up with these silly arguments here that have been so beautifully refuted again and again, just like the new atheists, constantly coming up with arguments that have long since been refuted, but they keep coming it up as if it's a new innovation. I promise you, the gospel, the scriptures, is an anvil that has worn down many hammers, and it will continue to do so. And though the people say that the Bible is really going to be gone, they're the ones who will be gone, and the scriptures will go on. It's like Voltaire. When Voltaire was the one who arrogantly claimed that the Bible will become totally irrelevant and will be no longer available. Ironically, Voltaire's gone, and his house was used as a printing press later for the printing of Bibles. That's what I call a delicious irony. You know, So I promise you, it'll continue, and that God's truth will continue. But at the point, theology was never meant to be innovative. The apostolic teaching is foundational. And when you try to innovate and move away from what has been understood by the church universal in the Apostles and Nicene Creeds, once you play games with that, you're beginning to play games with all of your basic theology, and your view of God has been diminished to a caricature at best, who's been created in your image. And that's what religion is always about, is to reduce God to manageable proportions so that he's not going to really do that. You see, that's the sort of mindset we have. Sorry for the diatribe, but I get weary because there's a growing spate of popular literature that are telling people what they want to hear, and it's tickling their ears, where people are hearing what they want to hear. And frankly, if I were to really think through the logical implications of these kinds of views, frankly, the God that they are pursuing is not a God worthy of worship. And frankly, my church, as I told you before, would be St. Mattress by the Spring. Or if you want, Bedside Baptist or a Pastor Pillow. That would be my church. At any rate. One more, Church of the Inner Spring. How's that?
Thank you for listening to this talk, which is part of a series of messages by Dr. Ken Boa. To order additional talks on CD or MP3, or to learn about any of Dr. Boa's other Bible-based teachings, go to our web ministry at kenboa.org. That's kenboa.org. Or call 1-800-DRAW-NEAR. That's 1-800-372-9632.